Elra.
Previously on Legacy Door.
If I hear from her, I'll take a chance and let you know.
Do you want the deets on the actual job?
Not here. Message me.
For client Jonathan Strauss, background and current status check on Frank Lutcher.
You said current status. Did you know this guy is dead?
Thanks for the heads up. He's still relevant, but it can wait until you have time tomorrow.
You're not in some kind of trouble, are you, Justin?
You have made yourself a variable that I cannot predict, and that is unacceptable. If Miss Dorn here, or anyone else with apparent connection to the case, ever contacts you again, you are to send a detailed report of that contact to Duncan's email address. If you follow these instructions, you will prosper. If you deviate from them, things will go very badly for you.
Based on the movies, I should entrust a sealed letter with someone who mails it somewhere if they don't hear from me. I guess preferably a lawyer.
Justin Brandt?
No, I think he's got his hands full.
Legacy Door, Episode 3.7, Discovery.
Justin Brandt, 9:42 a.m. I arrived back at my firm, looking at life a whole new way and not liking it much. Theoretically, no longer running around with trouble should have simplified things, but my loyalty remained divided. I had to follow Strauss's orders, but I owed her some kind of message breaking things off. Because if not, I'd get one from her, eventually, and I'd have to either cover it up or disclose it, either of which could blow up in our faces, exposing her plans and my false loyalty. And, I thought as I navigated the hallway, it was now quite clear that Strauss's perception of my loyalty might be the factor determining whether I lived or died, and that something beyond my control might sway him at any time. I resolved to get my client files in order, so anyone who had to take over for me in the event of an untimely accident could do so smoothly. For the pro bono bankruptcies, I should find someone who prioritized such things to commit to being my backup. Louise was a good egg, and I'm sure she'd encourage someone at the firm to step forward, but lawyers who aren't being paid can be pretty variable in their diligence, and those clients couldn't afford any slip-ups. These thoughts had me unaware of my surroundings until Haley Davis placed herself athwart the path to my office door. She was in another colorful suit, every color different from the previous day, but to identical effect, at least to my eye.
"Hey, boss,"
she said, a term she only used with the utmost playfulness. "Hey, hey," I replied, deciding to live up to the title. "Walk with me." We entered the office, and I, by nervous instinct, closed the door. Someone monitoring me closely might have noticed that I rarely did that when I was with a colleague rather than a client, but otherwise it should have been pretty innocuous. Haley, however, sensed my nerves immediately.
"I don't have much more on Frank Lutcher,"
she said, again parking herself on the corner of my desk while I took my seat.
"Partly because I haven't had time, partly because there's not much low-hanging fruit. I've been taking a couple electronic long shots to put off doing real legwork. Some interesting stuff. His father's uncle was a Nazi war criminal."
I blinked several times. I'd forgotten her assignment. I'd have to put an end to it immediately. And yet... "What?" was the sum total of my thinking.
"Yeah, a pretty big one,"
she said, consulting notes on her phone.
"He served 10 years in Spandau prison. Did you know they only had 8 inmates?"
"Can't say that I did," I answered. These seemingly irrelevant factoids might be vitally useful in Vanessa's crazy world, but if I was going to keep working in mine, I had to pull the scab off right now.
"What? Are you busy? Should I get out of here?"
"Yeah, but wait," I answered quickly. "You know how mad you were ready to be with me yesterday?"
"Mm-hmm."
"You were right, and I was wrong. I should never have put you on this. I just talked to the client, and he's decaying this whole part of things, and the best thing for me to do is make sure it never shows up on his bill. I'm just about to send something to Louise eating shit and taking full responsibility for the waste of time. I'm thinking of adding on about how quickly you got to it, given your schedule."
"Fuck that. Don't do me any favors. I know you think you're helping, but that just makes me a bigger target. Let them forget I was even involved. Justin, I asked you, to your face, if you were all right. I told you there were stakes for me, for my job here, and you already knew there was a problem, didn't you?
I'm telling you now that I did not know there was a problem. Because if I did, then one of us should have done something about it, and neither of us did.
It's like that, huh? There's something going on here.
Everything that's going on that is relevant to our work will be in my memo to Louise.
What about the thing we agreed wouldn't be part of our work? What about Corva Reese?
What about her?
I found the school friend. That was the main reason I came up to you.
I closed my eyes to think, then opened them again, and met her gaze with difficulty. Well, as you say, that's personal. So, as a personal favor, could you send the information to a friend of mine? Using your personal account, not the firm's.
And never speak of it again?
Probably, but not absolutely. I wouldn't suggest starting up a correspondence with my friend. They seem to create trouble wherever they go.
And should I send them my useless information about Frank Lutcher?
My eyebrows raised of their own accord. My God, that was tempting. No, I said quietly. That's work product for a client. You can't send that out on a personal account. What kind of circus do you think we're running here? Hoping Haley took that the way I meant it, I wrote Vanessa's burner phone number on a post-it and looked up at her to hand it over. As she took it, her smile got a little less grim and her tone regained a little of our usual banter.
Oh, of course. I don't know what came over me. I'll get right on that, boss, and close up the investigation. No final report needed, I take it?
No, nothing. Not even a cover sheet, unless Louise wants one. Just note your time. Thank you so much for what you've done and for being so understanding. I owe you big time.
Yeah, you do. So just to make sure everything's covered, since even in my personal dealings I try to be thorough, do you have a personal message for this troublesome friend?
Yes. Tell them I can't do what they wanted. And goodbye. But don't mention me by name.
Got it. I'll pass that along to her. And you take better care of yourself.
I made the smallest possible laugh. She was showing off that she was smarter than me, and I was in no position to dispute her. Possibly unsatisfied with my nonverbal response, she gave me an actual punch on the arm. I took it, quietly, although it felt like I now had a dent from her right-hand ring. She then turned around and started to leave.
Open or closed?
She asked, referring to how she should leave the door. Open. I'm all out of secrets.
Vanessa Dorn, 10:11 a.m. Vanessa remained at the coffee shop, using it as her headquarters for as many preparations as she could think of, while keeping sleep at bay with the strongest coffee they had. Joyce, meanwhile, was out making preparations of her own, which included assembling a chain of friends of friends, the last of whom would pick up Vanessa's things and check her out of the motel. Joyce had said that task rabbiting was a good idea, but that with her connections, she could improve on it, avoiding the use of credit cards and utilizing people with established skills of evasion. Vanessa gratefully left that in Joyce's capable hands and dealt with the question of which lawyer would have the honor of carrying her envelope of secrets. This took some winnowing, as she knew quite a few attorneys. There was the St. Louis firm she'd clerked at over the summer, but she felt that they might be under surveillance. After all, she reasoned, she was doing this because it seemed the obvious thing to do. It could seem just as obvious to someone opposing her. And the same logic disqualified people she'd known at law school. There were family friends, but Ven didn't feel like she could trust any of them. Her father's lawyer, Mrs. Alipour, had always seemed extremely upright, and according to Dan, was no fan of the logicians. But it still seemed dangerous to go to someone so close to her father. But maybe the next best thing would be safer. John O., who she'd met when he'd assisted Mrs. Alipour on some business a couple years earlier. He'd left an impression of confidence and earnestness, but they'd had no tangible correspondence that might tie them together. It was a gamble, but it seemed slightly better than picking someone completely at random. She called his firm and used the name Carrie Taylor, a girl from her and Abby's dance classes. As the receptionist was telling her that O was on another call, three text messages came in, all from a number Vanessa didn't know. She tried to keep the messages out of her mind as she navigated the conversation, but the knowledge of their existence made the brief series of questions seem to stretch out interminably. Yes, she would like a callback. No, she didn't have a detail message for Mr. O. Yes, she was a new client. No, she had not been referred by anyone nor seen an advertisement. And finally, thank you and goodbye was the end of their business. That done, she could finally survey the three text previews. Lois Allman, school friend of Corver Reese, is expecting to be contacted at... Take a look at https://en.wikipedia.org/wiki/Wilhelm_Lutcher. Your friend can't do what you wanted and says goodbye. She had a feeling that these three together told a story, and that the last one was the key to it. The first looked like information Justin had hoped for from his paralegal. So the third message seemed to mean that Justin Brandt was done, or at least done with her. Either they'd gotten to him, or he considered it too dangerous, probably because of some change in circumstances. This news was very unwelcome, but the excitement of new information anesthetized the sting of it, and the tunnel vision brought by lack of sleep helped as well. The first message included the word expecting, so she figured she should prioritize it, much though she'd rather hit that Wikipedia link. She selected the number and touched the phone icon to dial it.
Hello?
Said a girlish voice that sounded somewhere between uncertain and excited. Hello, my name is Vanessa Dorn. She decided that honesty would be best when dealing with someone whose only reason to help her was common humanity. I was hoping to talk to you about Corver Reese.
Oh, right. I was hoping that was it when my phone rang. I didn't recognize the number, so I figured if it wasn't you, it'd be spammers.
Wonderful. When would be a good time?
Well, I'm volunteering tomorrow, so I'd say any time that's good for you, but today if possible.
Where do you live? The voice gave an address in Hyde Park. Vanessa didn't want to trek all the way back to the South Side, but reminded herself how lucky it was that the woman didn't live on a coast or abroad, as could easily have been the case. How about noon? Vanessa asked.
That sounds great. Should I put out some food? I love making charcuterie boards.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
Delightful. See you then, Vanessa. Goodbye.
Goodbye, returned Vanessa, shaking her head as she terminated the call. The extreme friendliness was unexpected, but she resolved to accept her good fortune, cautiously. Vanessa had her phone plan the trip, then texted Joyce to have the car back by their new estimated time of departure. And then she finally felt ready to open the Wilhelm Lutcher article. She was just looking back at the link when her phone rang with a call from John O's office. This is Carrie, she answered quietly.
Hello, Miss Taylor. This is John O.
Thank you, Mr. O. I have something urgent to consult with you about, but I'm in public on an insecure line, so I have to be circumspect.
Vanessa hoped she was overstating the insecurity, but keeping her business with John O. secret, not just for now, but permanently, was a high priority. If the conspiracy had national security connections, she shouldn't use any words that a computer might search for, now or in the future.
All right.
I would like to retain you for a personal transactional matter. I would entrust you with certain packets of documents, have you store the packets without reading them, and would enclose instructions on where to send them if you don't hear from me by the 25th of each month. Once you send them out, your task would be over. I can assure you ahead of time that these documents would not include any obscenity, encouragement to commit a crime, or any threats against those you send them to. Can you do that?
That sounds like something I can do,
he said, sounding careful. Her law school ears could practically hear him not ask if there was defamation involved. That would be asking his client for a legal conclusion they weren't qualified to make.
And I'd encourage you to speak with me more about your situation when you're better able to talk freely, because it sounds like you might be in need of legal advice.
Thank you. That means a lot to me. I'll have the documents delivered very soon. I would also like to include a retainer to cover setting up this agreement and the first month of the entrustment. How soon could you text an estimate of that?
I can tell you right now that if everything is as you describe, A full year should be well under my firm's minimum retainer of $2,000. Anything not charged by the time the work is finished could be refunded.
That sounds perfect, said Vanessa, trying to sound pleased, despite physically feeling the gouge that amount would make in her secret bank account.
I would like to write up what we've talked about and add some standard information in a representation agreement for you to sign. Can I email it to you so you can include a signed copy with the rest?
Vanessa thought fast. She didn't like the built-in permanency and easy computer searchability of email, and the ultimate traceability of any account she might set up in haste. Can you give that to my associate? I could U.S. mail it back to you before you do any work beyond taking possession of the packets.
Sure. I'll have it ready. When should I expect your associate?
Within the hour. Minimum would be 25 minutes.
I can do that,
he said, and this time she could hear his effort to not express how unwelcome that time limit was.
Be sure to read the agreement, as it'll include some caveats about how I'll proceed if I'm unable to consult with you.
Thank you so much. I'm sure you'll do your best. Also, please leave a place for me to write in my real name. I'd like as much as possible to be filed under the name I gave you, but the papers will indicate my real one. There was a pause. Then John added,
I'm glad you mentioned that now.
He proceeded to tell her a simplified version of how the firm would handle that, and the limitations thereof, especially if they turned out to already represent someone else who was on the other side of a legal matter. She didn't like these limitations, but figured there was no way around them at this point, and asked some follow-up questions, which seemed to display enough knowledge of the issues to convince him that she understood him. That all works, she finally said. Thank you for explaining it to me.
Great. I'll expect your associate. I'm not sure if I'll be able to see them in person, and nothing we say will be fully confidential, so I'd suggest putting everything you want me to know in a cover letter.
Okay, will do. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Vanessa quickly put together the write-up she'd been updating, plus a note reminiscing non-specifically about their last in-person meeting and apologizing for making things difficult. She didn't mention his name or firm in any of it, in case the electronic documents were somehow intercepted. She zip-compressed the whole thing, hoping this would delay such interception, and submitted it for printing at an office supply store on the way to O's building. That done, she finally went back to the text messages and clicked on Wilhelm Lutscher's Wikipedia link. The familiar article format made it feel like leisure reading after all the law talk, but Vanessa kept the high stakes in mind. A formal black-and-white portrait photo dominated the top of the page. Looking at Wilhelm, unsmiling, seated at his desk, a fedora hat between his hands, Vanessa thought she saw some resemblance to the family members she'd known, but nothing inescapable. His face looked a little potato-like, whereas the admixture of other chromosomes and rolls of the genetic dice had made Frank's longer and thinner, and Dan's, Teresa's, and her own more classical and high-cheeked. The closest resemblance was probably to Dan's father, Thomas, in the similarly black and white portrait of their parents, which still hung in the family living room. Moving her eyes to the text, she read that Wilhelm had been a German financier from a wealthy Saxon banking family, no names or links given. He was born in 1903, which made him the third youngest of the 8 major Nazi war criminals eventually imprisoned in Spandau. He joined the party early, but didn't play a notable role in any activities prior to Hitler's seizure of power. He eventually became a junior member of the Nazi Party Chancellery and was appointed German Minister Without Portfolio in 1941, at the age of 38, after Rudolf Hess was stripped of that post. But there was no mention of how he had achieved those ill-defined offices, or what duties they entailed. Vanessa's legal education engaged on his prosecution at the Nuremberg trials, which had apparently been somewhat peculiar because the investigators couldn't find out much about him. He had no proven involvement in the Holocaust, but his party duties would necessarily have involved knowledge, and to some degree facilitation, of many party activities. There was a bare mention that his brother had died in a concentration camp with a citation needed tag from the Wikipedia editors. At the trial itself, he reportedly expressed remorse for all the regime's actions and mounted no defense beyond disclaiming any positive part in the death camps and an unsupported story of having declined an SS commission offered by Heinrich Himmler. This lack of defense meant the prosecution was able to get a conviction without much evidence, but he was only given 10 years, the minimum amount for malefactors on his level. The article suggested that something akin to a plea bargain might have taken place, although these had been explicitly disallowed by the court's founding rules. He had then served his full decade at Spandau and was released in 1956. He returned to his home city of Dresden in communist East Germany and lived entirely out of the public eye, never writing memoirs as most of the others did. His money having been seized, he lived on public assistance with no known employment for more than 30 years, outliving the other Spandau Seven when Hess died in 1987. Lutscher was found dead in his state-provided apartment in 1990 at the age of 87, cause unknown but, quote, probably related to an undiagnosed heart condition, unquote. Found on the scene was a signed but undated typed will, leaving his possessions to his housing complex, and requesting that his body be cremated and his ashes anonymously scattered, so that his burial would not create a focus for the, quote, misguided adherence of my mistaken former beliefs, unquote. A picture of this document was attached, and Vanessa saved it, intending to check the signature against Frank's handwriting if she got a chance. Just one news article about the death was referenced, from a West German paper. It was not available online, but was summarized as saying that while the precise cause of Lutscher's death was unknown, it seemed like an appropriately timed close to a historical chapter, just when the isolated country he had lived in for so long and so quietly was about to rejoin the rest of Germany and move into the future. Vanessa felt that this flippant dismissal of a mysterious death would have been chilling if the life in question hadn't been so unrelatable. She tried to scroll further, but the entry was over, with no mention of descendants or any other family. Vanessa didn't detect any smoking guns in the article, but she found enough resonances to be in no doubt that he was tied to the legacy. She could hear Jonathan Strauss's cavalier attitude toward his trial in Wilhelm Lutscher's unorthodox defense at Nuremberg, and his vague came-from-money-past sounded like the Strausses too, or Harriet Rees and her grandmother. But the kicker was the mysterious death in the jarringly recent year of 1990, the same year she couldn't help remembering that Frank Lutscher had engaged in his relationship with Harriet, fathered Harrison, and undergone his final personality transformation. She stared at the eyes of the picture taken in 1936. They were not uncannily blank, nor crazed, but still seemed to have an otherworldly look that she could relate to Frank. She supposed the manic quality had come later, from some combination of Nazi experiences and decades of solitude. This man being inhabited by the same persona that later animated Frank did not seem certain, but there was just enough there to make it terrifyingly plausible. She put her phone on the table, closed her eyes, and cast her mind back through her feeble collection of half-remembered family facts. Her great-grandmother had escaped Germany in some sort of devil's bargain that involved her leaving her husband behind. That husband might have been Wilhelm, but Vanessa guessed it was the unnamed brother who died in a camp. Vanessa continued down the timeline. The great-grandmother had brought her infant son with her, Carl, Vanessa's grandfather. He later met Grandma Lily and married her. They had three children, Frank, Tom, and Therese. Then died in their 50s as those three reached adulthood, following which Frank had seemed increasingly stressed. Not long afterward, in 1990, Wilhelm died. And if Antoinette's theories held, whatever lived in Wilhelm crossed the ocean and two generations to take over Frank, while Frank's real personality found itself in a dead body, which was then cremated and scattered anonymously to keep it from becoming a neo-Nazi relic. And in the new body, the former Wilhelm had lived on to see Ven and Dan born and eventually terrorize them when they made out at Thomas's funeral. And now, perhaps, he had switched again, taking Dan's body, because one of his alien masters had decided it was time.
"I'd offer you a penny for your thoughts,"
said a voice above Vanessa.
"But maybe we should save that for the drive."
Vanessa opened her eyes and saw Joyce looking down at her. Vanessa smiled upward without trying to disguise her sadness. "Lots of good progress, lots of bad signs," she said solemnly. "You all ready?"
"Yep."
"Excellent. Let's roll." They walked out to where the silver Ford waited, orange lights blinking to indicate that its stay would be short. Joyce offered Vanessa the keys, but she declined, feeling that she should concentrate on filling the other woman in on developments. While beginning this task, Vanessa fished a lighter, fancier top, skirt, and shoes out of her bag in the back seat, and discreetly changed into them. Joyce smiled. Her new friend might have lived a sheltered life, but it definitely wasn't her first in-car quick change. By the time Vanessa finished her story, they had also visited a bank drive-thru, made a large cash withdrawal, and were approaching the office supply store parking lot, all while Joyce tried to accept that the ever-expanding parameters of the conspiracy could be real.
Nazis! I suppose they had to work into this somehow. Is this all some kind of Fourth Reich conspiracy?
I don't know. Antoinette said that Jonathan never said anything particularly racist to her, just generally misanthropic, and his ancestors were all over the map religion-wise, including Jewish.
Hmm. So we can't blame the conspiracy for every terrible thing people do to each other? That's too bad. But I suppose that still leaves them with the capacity to squash us and get away with it.
If they see that as the only way, I have no doubt that's what'll happen. That's why we're picking our battles.
How much sleep did you get last night?
Basically none. Naps here and there. Been too busy getting the packet together. I feel focused, but without much control over what I focus on, like a law school all-nighter.
Well, take another nap now, before you start me yawning too, and I drive us into a lamppost.
The image of that came to Vanessa with uncanny vividness, mixed with old imaginings of the death of her mother and her mother's friend, Jeff. But rather than shocking her awake, these thoughts drew her into dreamland without another word.
You have been listening to Legacy Door, episode 3.7, Discovery. John Dre was Justin Brandt. Song Marshall was Haley Davis. Stacy Tappan was Vanessa Dorn. Daniel Yee was John O. Teresa Echeveste was Lois Allman. And Michelle Lamone was Joyce Vera. The opening music was Ethereal Thoughts by Victor Wayne. The closing music is The Fall of Memphis by Eway Sound. You can hear more from them on Toon Tank. The Legacy Door cover photograph is by Roxana Inash. This episode's cover image is Portrait of an Unidentified Man with Glasses by Dorothy Lange. You can find more of her images at the New York Public Library Digital Collection. So now that our heroes have discovered some things previously covered, they can take some time out to hang with the mysteriously chipper Lois Allman in our next episode, Socializing. And you can socialize with us on Twitter, Blue Sky, Mastodon, and Facebook. Links to all of which can be found at our website, legacydoor.wordpress.com. You can also support us by reviewing us in Apple Podcasts or your podcatcher of choice, or purchasing the novel from Amazon or the audiobook at online stores including Audible. Also, while we're at it, thanks to Anthony James for using Twitter to alert us to some posting problems. Great use of social media, Anthony. This is presented by Dueling Genre Productions, home of many fine podcasts. Legacy Door is copyright 2021 by Bob J. Kester, all rights reserved. This is Bob J. Kester. Thank you for listening.
Dueling Genre.